You're listening to Face Off, episode 33, recorded August 30th, 2009. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes even by going to faceoffshow.com.
And subscribe to our feed at faceoffshow.com/subscribe.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the way to do it. Get those show notes delivered to your feeder.
That's the way to do it. So, Mark, how's it going? Another week, another show.
It's good.
What have you been up to?
Summer's nearing its end. Students are getting back in school.
Yeah, actually, there's like some kind of rowdy concert party going on next door. So
maybe we should head over there.
Yeah, we should. We should try and record. I'm really excited because it's football season, and I'm a football guy.
I've been getting into football because I've been playing Madden.
Yeah, we've been.
I'm normally not a football sports guy, but.
Yeah, I know. You know, it's weird. I've always loved sports video games. I've never spectated many sports.
Uh-huh.
You know, except for like high school ones where I had sort of a vested interest in it. But I started playing like baseball and football games with our mutual friend and my cousin, Taylor Olson. Uh-huh. And I never really was in football until we bought like a 4-year-old copy of it a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And started playing it just because we were really competitive and wanted some way.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, like, I became this huge football fan. And I've been following it really closely. Really excited about it this year. And I'm glad that you're kind of at least taking an interest in it, because it would be awkward recording the show.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I think most people, you know, watch the sports and then get into the video games, but I do the other way.
I did the same thing too. I've watched hockey a couple times locally because it's really fun. But you know, you and I have played. We played the NHL 10 demo, and
that was
so
fun.
Yeah, I'm probably going to start watching some professional hockey this year. I think. Yeah, we're doing about it backwards.
I was going to do the opposite of you. I had more hockey experience than football experience.
Well, your dad plays like amateur hockey, doesn't he? So yeah,
he's always played since he was.
My father hates
like my
sports.
Age, so.
Every sport my father hates. When we were kids, we played basketball, but he'd never any professional sport my father's never enjoyed. So you're lucky.
All right. Do we have any news and follow-ups
this
week?
Should we actually talk about web technology for a little bit of this show? We got no news and follow-ups this week.
No news and follow-ups, okay.
So let's get into our web apps. The first one we want to talk about, the first three are kind of grouped together. The first one is Stack Overflow.
Now, you might be saying, Stack Overflow, I know what that is. But it is so awesome that we have to share it. I mean,
yeah. Well, what is it? Somebody, if you've never been there before, what is it?
It's kind of like you know, Yahoo Ask Answers, or like the Experts Exchange. So you go on there and you've got a question about, and Stack Overflow is more about programming. So if you've got a question about programming, you know, how do I convert an array into a hash, or I don't know what you're doing, but if you've got a question, you go on there, you type it in, and people can answer your question. And then if somebody answers a question and you like that answer, you can upvote it and say that this answered my question. And then that person gets scored based on whether or not they answered your question. So you get kind of a reputation built up, and so you get decent answers for your questions.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's a great system.
Yeah. So like usually it's you go on, and if someone's answer is correct, you say, yeah, that's correct. And if it is voted the best answer of all, then you you get reputation points, which reputation is kind of key for this community.
Yeah. And, you know, other people have tried this. Yahoo Answers does it. Experts Exchange tried to do it. And I don't know. Their model kind of didn't work for me.
Yeah. You and I were talking about that today, how there's a lot of ideas that we sometimes say and we go, well, so-and-so did that already. But this is a perfect example of Yahoo Answers was around. Experts Exchange was quite the resource.
Yeah.
But we never got into it, especially Experts Exchange. It was just really greasy. But you and I were saying, you know, we never would have done this because we said this market already has big players in it.
Yeah.
But we realized that we didn't use it, and we're kind of the core demographic for an application such as this.
The main difference, I think, was Experts Exchange required you to have like an account just to even view the answers and the things, where Stack Overflow is very open. You don't even need to register to ask a question. You can do it anonymously.
Wow.
So they're very open about it.
Experts Exchange was very monetizing. Like, when you first signed up, you only had like enough points to ask one or two questions, and you had to answer questions to get more points or purchase points. So there was, well, there was a way at Experts Exchange that you could really make, and make, I'm not sure money. We can make money, but you could really get into the community. Maybe, I think you could make money. They may pay you for a correct answer or something. I can't remember, but yeah. It seemed really greasy, very monetized, heavily ad, you know, like they did weird stuff like trying, they would hide the content so that it would get indexed in Google. So you would go, you would search for your question and see like half of the answer in the Google result and then go to the webpage and they would try to obscure it so you couldn't find it. And
yeah.
It was just crazy.
But Stack Overflow has done it right, and they're getting very popular, and they've actually expanded to a couple of other websites that we'll talk about. But Stack Overflow, yeah, you go there, you ask a question, you get upvotes, kind of like the Dig social media structure.
So is this just, you know, PHP questions, just Ruby questions?
I believe it's just programming questions in general. I mean, they're, you know, they're based, their site is made in ASP, but there's a lot of Python, Rails, there's all kinds of questions on everything.
So if you go to tags, actually, this is the best way. You go to tags, you can you can filter by certain tags like Ruby tags, Ruby on Rails tags, PHP tags, Python. They have C++,
C Sharp is really popular on here.
Yeah, wow. You know, iPhone, MySQL, basically any aspect of programming. I mean, there's, you know, I think I've even seen like IDE questions before and stuff on here.
jQuery,
yeah,
a lot of JavaScript. XML, this looks like basically programming.
You can sort, you know, just if you want to answer questions, you can click at the top and sort by unanswered questions and go ahead and try and get some answers to those so you can get yourself some reputation.
Now, I haven't asked a question in this one, but I have asked a question in the ones we'll talk about in a second.
And okay, well,
it was great.
What's the next one?
Okay, the next one is server fault. This one's mainly server questions. That server system admin, you know, if you're going to run your own website or, I don't know, got a file server or something, you got a question on it, you know.
It's, you know, Stack Overflow for system administration, basically.
Yep.
Because it got the same things, you know, tags, unanswered questions if you want.
I'll pick one.
Featured questions.
Managing like a CentOS VPS with virtual private server through SSH. And it's got a lot of views and two answers. I mean, and the answers are usually like you're not going to get. It's not like a form where you're going to get like a one sentence answer or something. Mm-hmm. They really try hard to get to earn their points. So
yeah,
this question, this active. Answer here is like 1, 2, 5 paragraphs. It's got 4 upvotes. You know, it's very detailed. So
yeah, exactly. And I'm not sure about these other ones. I'm sure they're developing that. But like Stack Overflow has a very active community.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of people there that want to help you answer your question.
That's the thing. Like you might. I don't use forums much anymore because I want my question answered within 10 or 15 minutes. Otherwise, I can just Google for 10 or 15 minutes and eventually find the answer.
Yeah.
So, you know, I asked a question in the next one, which is Super User. So might as well talk about that one. Superuser.com. This is like power user, any questions about computers that a power user would want to know, not necessarily specific to programming or system admin. I asked a question in here, and within 10 minutes, I had an answer.
Wow.
Where I wasn't finding much on Google. So,
all right.
Yeah.
Here is the face-off challenge. I am challenging you. I'm going to find an unanswered question on Super User, Mark, and I'm going to see if you can answer it.
Okay.
Okay, and I'm going to scroll with my eyes shut so that I don't pick an intentionally hard one just to be a jerk. Okay, I'm scrolling the wheel. All right. Is that good? Is it random enough for you?
I hope it's not a Microsoft related question.
would you just be, oh, it's still scrolling. My little netbook can't keep up. Man. Okay.
What do we got?
How do you set the Windows XP lock screen background?
I have no idea.
Stumped. It has to be a registry setting. Oh dear.
I know. Okay, let me find a Linux one. I'm gonna find a Linux. Will lock the screen.
I'm gonna find a Linux one for you.
There. Yeah, you can go on the side. There's tags here, and you can click Linux, Ubuntu.
Oh, I should do that, huh?
There's the Linux tab. Right
I should.
Were you scrolling for one?
Yeah. Dang, there's a lot of Windows questions on here.
Here's one: how to synchronize a home folder between multiple computers.
Rsync.
Rsync is a good one. Also, I found a new one called Ubisun, I think it's called. Let me double check.
What's the one that we used for our DroboSyncs that encrypted it for you?
Duplicity. That's also a good one.
I like Duplicity.
That one is good because it encrypts it, where Rsync doesn't encrypt because it's not made for that. It's, you know, Linux apps, this is kind of off topic, I guess, but Linux apps are made to be specific to one small little thing and be very, very good at that. And then, you know, use another app. So, like, you're supposed to encrypt the data either through SSL or something else.
Well, I mean, there's a reason to use rsync without encrypting it. You know, why should it? Where is the Ubuntu tag? Dang it.
It's on the side. I saw it. Did you? The one I was sorry, Unison. So there's rsync and Unison are very good for syncing home folders. I have an article actually on NixTutor that I just wrote about creating an in-house like Dropbox where you're syncing home folders and things. So, but yeah, rsync is, can't recommend rsync enough. It's great.
Yeah, rsync is really cool. Okay.
But yeah, it's a great service. You can select, you know, the tag that you want to, like, if you're a Linux guy and you want to answer Linux questions, you can come in here and I can start answering questions and build up a reputation. Yeah,
there's all kinds of, this actually, I really like SuperUser. Stack Overflow is good. I don't use it enough because I don't really need to ask. I don't ask questions much. I have a lot I usually ask my coworkers and they can solve most of my questions.
Right.
I don't really use Server Fault because I don't system administer once, but there's a lot of really interesting topics on SuperUser. There's even hardware one, like peripheral questions, and you know how I feel about keyboards and mice and stuff. So I can answer those questions all day long. I get some awesome reputation.
Yeah.
But yeah, these are really great apps. These guys, they do a podcast called the Stack Overflow Podcast. I listen to it off and on.
Here's a good example. Like, you know, normally this guy's saying, is there an undo for like the command line? And most of the time, if you were to ask that in a form, they'd say, no, what do you, you know, don't be
noob.
Stupid. Don't use sudo and don't, you know, RM your, remove your entire directory or something. Instead, this guy said, you know, there's generally no undo. And if you accidentally RM, you'll have to use backup software. But, you know, you could add this alias into your bash rc and add the rm.i to your rm. And so which is interactive mode. And so when you remove stuff, it's going to ask you, like, are you sure you want to remove this thing?
So you could alias.
So like the guy said, you know, it's not possible, but hey, if you know, if you're worried about it, there's something you can do.
That's a great solution. Helpful. I would vote that up. I mean, that
makes
sense. It got
22 votes up.
Yeah.
So it's generally very helpful because you, like you said, you have the reputation on the line. It's a good model that they have. And I think it's, you know, if you were to ask me a year ago, you know, I'm going to start this site up that's going to do all these questions and all this stuff, I would have said, well, they've already had that. It's Expert Exchange. It just doesn't do very well.
Yeah, exactly.
But this seems to work great. So
yeah, how long has Stack Overflow been around? Do you know?
I've only known about them for maybe a year.
Yeah, me too.
But I'm not sure
when they started. So check them out. Stack Overflow, Server Fault, and SuperUser. Very cool apps. Get on there. These apps are just, they're made exponentially better by the number of people that use them and just even browse them and look at them. So go check them out.
What do we got next?
The next web app I want to talk about is called VAP URL.
VAP URL. Yeah, this sounds like a tiny URL thingy.
What is this? And there's lots of those out there.
There's too many of those.
But this one has a slight twist. What it does is you can make a tiny URL, you know, a hashed sort of hidden URL that will disappear after a certain number of, you know, visits or a certain amount of time.
Wow.
So
like coupons and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I envision this for like deals. Like, let's say you're a company and you're like, oh, first, you know, for 1 hour only, get this special deal. And you use this VAP URL that'll point to, you know, whatever your coupon page is or whatever. And people can do it from there.
So what happens after the hour expires and they click on the link? Is it 404?
That's a good question. I haven't checked because I haven't really.
I thought, okay, we need to check into that.
Yeah. But I mean, I thought this would just be kind of a fun little one because you're like, oh, well, here, I'm going to make visit one to jaderobbins.com, vaporize my link, VAP URL.
I think I read when we were looking at this, I think I read where it gives some contact information.
Oh, really?
Maybe I might be wrong.
Okay, so I'm going to do it again. I just visited that once. It just takes you to the VAP URL homepage.
Oh, okay.
So
that's okay, I guess.
That's okay, yeah. But if you only want, and what's nice is, like time stuff, you know, time-sensitive URLs, or even let's just say you don't want to keep, you know, some people don't want these tiny URLs around forever. Yeah. I don't know why you wouldn't, but if you do, you can use VAP URL. Really small, really simple.
Oh, that's, yeah. Coupons for sure. I can see this being used.
The next web app that we want to talk about is called the, and I, I can't pronounce. It's like Mibu, M-I-B-E-W, Mibu.
Mibu.
Mibu. Mibu Messenger. What this is an open source application that is used for live support that is written in PHP, MySQL. It enables sort of like one-on-one chat assistance for your website or for your product. And it's open source and it's pretty cool. We were playing around with it last night. What did you think, Mark?
So this is one of those things where you have like this live support thing, you click it and then it's like waiting for an assistant. Somebody comes in and you can say, hey, I'm having a problem with this part of the website. And they said, oh, I'm sorry, you're having a problem. And you can chat back and forth with this. This is awesome that it's open source and now I can implement this in my site, or, if I need live customer support. I've always wondered how they did it and how I've always thought about the programming question of how I would make this. And I was like, oh, that's a real time chat app, this is awesome that it's open source and I can just go here, implement it, change the looks of it, change the way it works and this is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So we were playing around with it last night. I made a link for Mark to go to. And so I'm sitting there and it just pretty much sits there saying, waiting for anyone to show up. Once Mark loaded in, he clicked the link. You have to put in some information about your question. So you're not just going in, blind. You say, hey, I can't find this on your website. So then I was sitting there and all of a sudden it said, hey, you've got one customer who wants, waiting for someone to talk to. It tells you how long they've been waiting, things like that. So then I click on it and it, pops up and it says, and then it's like, oh, and it tells me what your issue that you wrote down, why you're here. And then I can say like, hey, so what problems are you having with finding this on our website? I don't think we have that on our website, or here's the link, for what you were looking for.
Yeah, a lot of times people don't want to call into the company and go through 10 different phone menus and finally get to the person and they say, oh, you mean this department? You're in the wrong spot and transfer. And it's just becoming a pain. And if you're able to go online and just chat with somebody instantly, that makes a big difference. I know I've used these on Quest.com. I've asked them questions without having to call in and it's been great.
Dell pops these up every 5 seconds when you're shopping. If you shop on their business side of their website, like we were looking for at work some sort of enterprise level storage, and every 5 minutes, like, you want to talk to Adele Associate? They want to help you. And I'm like, no, I'm just looking. But I agree. No one wants to call in anymore. Email can kind of be a pain if you're a person that just needs quick help, quick. Why should you have to send an email? Wait 10 minutes. And plus, let's say if you have any sort of support personnel, this also helps fully utilize their time. Yeah. There's times where if there is nothing to do, they're kind of sitting there, surfing Facebook. But this way, customers will be more apt to ask for help and therefore help utilize their time fully.
Yeah, it's less expensive than having a phone call center and having to answer all these phone
calls. Exactly.
And having a phone system.
Yeah, you could have, not even if you just have specifically support staff, you could have all of your employees just idling in here and helping people out when they have time.
Yeah, this would be great for a web host company or any kind of a more tech-savvy company.
Yeah, exactly. So check it out. It's at openwebim.org, which apparently was its old name.
And it's open source, and it's cool.
Yeah, exactly. What I'm really curious of is I want to dig into it. So the WordPress is programmed beautifully. There's a lot of hardcore stuff going on in WordPress, but they've done a really good job of writing and maintaining good code. So I've kind of gotten spoiled. Every once in a while, sometimes I'll open up an open source project, and I go to get under the hood a little bit. Yeah, crack my knuckles and be like, all right, let's go. And then you're like, whoa, are they doing? So I'm kind of curious because I would like to play around with this and see, how I can hack it and maybe try and integrate it into an existing site or something. But hopefully it's nice. We'll have to take a look. But check it out. That wraps it up for our news follow-ups, which there were none, and web apps. I want to remind you guys that if you have some news or a follow-up or a web app that you want us to look at, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Specifically, if you really want, call us at 31Web2Tech and let us know what we should check out, or give us an update on something that we got wrong or some news that's happening. We'd love to hear from you guys.
Yep. So let's dig into our first topic. What do we got the first one?
The first topic is 5 things that will kill your website.
Uh-oh.
That doesn't sound good at all.
So the 5 kind of things are change, unexpected load, slow death, which means you're not updating it or anything, time-related issues, and hardware failure.
Okay.
Okay.
So change. I mean, this is kind of one of those weird ones. People don't like change.
Yeah.
At all.
Oh, man.
They just, we don't, you know, but at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, last episode, we recommend change your website, make updates to it all the time.
Yeah. But we specifically said you have to be careful.
Drastic.
Simple things like changing your theme, but keeping this sort of navigation tree structure the same really helps people out.
Yeah.
You know, keeping sort of the same structure of your web page, but updating the colors and the pictures, make them new, exciting.
Exactly.
So, you know, when they come in, people go, ooh, this is all new and exciting, but it's not completely new and exciting because they don't feel like they have to relearn it.
Yeah, make, you know, add new features and things, but don't, like, totally change the layout and the way things drastically. I mean, could you imagine logging into Gmail and they moved all the navigation to the right side and, like, just totally changed it.
Oh, it would kill everything because...
But if they had a new feature or something where you could add that to your Gmail...
Exactly.
That's okay.
Yeah, or a new theme so you can go in. You know, they are adding neat themes once in a while and you can get a new one that makes it all pretty. Yeah, that's great. People love that. But it's just, it's really funny. There's, you know, sort of in management theory... there's a giant chunk of it dedicated to resistance to change. I mean, you have to, people really don't like change at all. And it's really tough to facilitate it and to sort of lubricate the process of changing things.
Another thing they're recommending here is to, you know, and I noticed Google does this a lot, is email the customers and saying, hey, we're making a change in the next month.
Exactly.
So get ready for it. And then once they actually make the change, they might have like a notice on the top of the website or something saying, hey, this is a new change here. If you're wondering what's going on, click here to read about it or whatever. And so they really make sure that you know what changes, a major change is coming. And then, you know, if you didn't know, it's saying, hey, there's a change. Read it here.
Yeah, there's like three, if I remember correctly, I think there's like sort of three key things to lessening resistance to change. One is time, and the other is notice or notification. Mm-hmm. You know, lots of time, lots of notification. I can't remember the third one, but like you basically just hit the two big ones right there. You know, give people time and let them know while you're giving them time. Say, hey, in 6 months this is going to happen. You know, send them periodic reminders to say, hey, you just want to remind you this is going to be happening. So like, you know, exactly, like email your customers, like log in a month to check out our new website. It's going to be so awesome. We're really excited.
Yep.
You know, don't be like, we're changing our website. You're going to have to learn this whole new website. You know, it's like, it's exciting. You're like, all right, it's going to be new and fresh. Come check it out.
And the more mission critical it is, the absolute longer you need to notify people and keep it in front of them. Like I know, UPS, if they make a change to their API, they're telling you like 6 months to a year in advance. They're like, hey, we're changing this. Get ready. And they're going to send an email like every month until they change it.
Yeah, exactly.
And but the funny thing is they'll still have people complain once they change it. Be like, my stuff broke and he didn't tell me.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is don't change your entire layout all at once unless you're making changes like notifications or, you know, kind of generally avoid it. But if you have to, you know, make some change. Make
well, let's say if you have a really big change you want to make incremental changes to it, right? Mm-hmm. Start shifting your layout and navigation little chunks at a time so that people aren't totally lost if they don't come to your web, you know.
And it's okay to add features and do little changes. That's actually a great thing to do. So
absolutely.
There is a difference between the two.
This next one is unexpected load. This is the first line of this paragraph is this is the dig TechCrunch effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, this is like Twitter. Twitter could have, if they had, you know, they had quite a lot of problems for a while there with the fail whales and things. If they had, you know, let's say they had maybe double the problems, we might not have had Twitter. Maybe something else would have popped up and people would have switched over.
Yeah. It
could have killed it.
It almost happened. I mean, I remember like the great Twitter outages a couple of years ago. Some of the big internet celebrities like Leo Laporte were really pushing Jaiku because they said, hey, don't put up with this the Twitter junk. And it definitely could have gone that way. You're absolutely correct. It could have gone the other way. People would be using a different service. It happens a lot. These websites will get on Dig, like the Dig effect, you know, which is getting on the front page of Dig is a freaking gold mine of traffic, right?
Yeah.
But if it gets the dig effect and dies after like 23 digs, people are gone. They will never look at your website again. They hate you. As a matter of fact, they are angry that you didn't prep your website good enough for them.
Yep. At the very least, have like a static, have a fail whale, have a static image. Don't have a 404 or something,
exactly.
You know. So they're saying degrade gracefully. and, you know, with services like Amazon EC2 or is it EC3? I can never remember the acronyms. But with, you know, Amazon, the CloudFront stuff, I don't know. If you're medium-sized, you shouldn't really have this problem. You should be able to scale.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's no reason to have this if you're at that level.
Well, we talked about, we also talked about a lot of caching things. I mean, if you can cache static pages or cache, you know, MySQL calls or database calls, you can handle quite a bit of traffic.
A lot more.
A static HTML website, a really, really crappy web server can pump those out faster than anyone's business, right?
Yep.
If there's no processing behind the back end except for pumping out a file, that's no big deal.
Yep.
Number three is the slow death, and this is just the sort of things that will creep up on you. Let's say you're using a piece of software that has a memory leak, you know, even if it's a little one, we tend to, especially with our servers and stuff, we just shove them in a closet and never look at them again.
Just a little slower and
slower.
Yeah,
it just gets a little bit slower, and you start
to neglect it a little bit.
Exactly, and so you need to keep up on this stuff. Things like if you have alerts for when your stuff is down, even alerts for when it isn't down, like if you know, reaching, you know, 80% of your RAM usage.
Yeah.
You especially need to be careful on these with a lot of these smaller virtual machines or virtual hosts where you have a lot of things going on at once.
Definitely.
You know, these virtual machines come with, like, you know, your base one is, you know, let's say like 1.6 gigahertz, you know, with 2 gigs of RAM or something. That slow chunk of eating up stuff really can impact your performance.
It's a good point. If you do have a virtual private server, maybe you, like, set up alerts, like my, you know, 80% the memory, send an email saying, hey,
yeah,
it's getting full, or
you know, once a month, have a scheduled restart, you know, set a cron job that says, you know, especially a virtual machine that's really small, it'll reboot in 10 seconds. You know, you can handle 10 seconds of downtime to make sure your performance is snappy the rest of the month.
Yeah, and you can even do, there's scripts out there that'll measure your, you know, response time. And if it's starting to get a little bit slower and a little bit slower over the month or whatever,
you might
have a memory link, you could, like you said, restart.
Yeah, exactly.
Then number four is time-related problems.
Yeah, there's a lot of time-related problems, especially with, daylight savings time is really weird. I remember my buddy was writing a program for scheduling employees where I used to work, and daylight savings time really was giving him a lot of fits. It's just kind of goofy. There's a lot of, you know, like PHP obviously had things built in to tell whether or not something was in, you know, if we were in daylight savings time or not, but it's really a pain. And especially like now that they changed it.
Yeah,
like that
definitely
was really, like, not cool.
If you've got like a license that's set to expire on a certain day and you know, your users are in a different time zone, it could get tricky.
Yeah. Actually, that happens at the university a lot.
Does it?
Licenses, if you're not, well, your certs, if you're not up on your certs and they expire, your domain expires, you know, you've been getting notices from GoDaddy for 4 months and ignore them every time because you say, oh, that's 4 months away. And then all of a sudden your website's down.
Trying to notify you of change.
Yeah. I did that. I'm going to be honest with you.
We changed our SSL. You're right, though. They send like 8 emails before it's over, and you ignore until it's like, oh, we have 2 days.
Montana Fragfest expired last year, and I had to.
I
was really embarrassed.
I redid our SSL like 2 days before it expired.
Nice,
but yeah, definitely
be aware
watch out
of those
for that stuff.
Yeah.
Number five is hardware failure.
I want to go back. A lot of these, so what we found when we were working with it, I'm trying to think how to word this properly. When you usually, you're testing your website now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this article stresses this, and it's really important to, you know, maybe change your server's system time to 6 months from now and see
what happens.
What happens. The problem is we didn't find a lot of our daylight savings problems until the day of daylight savings time. And all of a sudden, you know, our employees logged in and they're like, I don't have a schedule. And we're like, okay.
Interesting.
You know, or we did this automated script to populate the schedule for the entire semester. Uh-huh. And all of a sudden, you know, for some reason it goofed up and the last week was broken. But we didn't look in the last week. Mm-hmm. We ran the script and we said, oh, great. Yeah, this week's populated. Next week's populated. Okay, it worked. You know, we didn't look at all the time ranges on it.
I could see like cron jobs and things getting met. Like if you have a certain task to set up at like midnight and daylight saving comes on, it, you know, an extra hour could cause some more load time or who
absolutely
knows what.
Absolutely.
Unexpected results.
And we did it all in timestamps, which are daylight savings times insensitive. So it was
like
really
second
weird.
Second since 1970 or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So it was really goofy because you really had to subtract that amount of time or add it depending upon where you were in daylight savings time. I hate daylight savings time personally.
It's tricky.
I think it's stupid.
All right, so we go to
there was my rant. I think it's stupid and I hate it. Next.
Use Unix timestamps. Today is 212,000.
Hey, Mark, what time you got? 12,695,932. Oh, crap, I'm late.
Number five is hardware failure. Yeah.
Oh.
You know, this is why we bought Drobos and things like this.
Yeah, so. Exactly.
Hardware fails.
It fails and you need redundancy on it. Yeah, there's certain things. Like, I do virtual hosting through DreamHost because I don't want to have to worry about hardware failures. But hopefully, like, if you're doing VPSs and stuff. But in general, I mean, like, I was thinking about this today. If my microphone broke, we could still record the show. But if our mixer broke, we couldn't.
Yeah.
So try to make sure you have some redundancy.
Yeah, like, you know, have a load balancer, have multiple servers in case one's down, have a backup of your VPS.
Have readily available hardware for your server. So if you're doing it yourself, like if your CPU dies, make sure you can either you have one on hand, which seems a little unrealistic, or you can get one fast.
Yeah, have maybe mirror your database, have two sets.
Yeah, you and I we encrypt we have stuff on our Drobo which has drive redundancy built into it. Plus, we are syncing to each other's Drobos at off-site. Night, specific offsite folders so that...
with duplicity.
Duplicity. So it's encrypted. So you can't look at my stuff.
That's important.
But yeah, things are going to break. It always sounds like they're not going to, but they will. And
you had a hard drive crash on you. You lost some stuff that you can't get back.
Yeah, I did. And it was the same mentality. It was a hard drive in my computer. I had two hard drives, but they weren't rated. But I thought, well, I'll just take care of it later. You know, I was like, I remember thinking at one point, I was like, I really should back up my wedding photos. And I said, I'll do that later. And that hard drive's not going to crash. and then just one day, I mean, I came home from work and the hard drive was clicking and it was gone.
It was making some noise. It almost like it had an internal speaker.
Yeah, it was weird.
It was crazy. I remember that.
But it was dead. And I basically lost the raw high quality versions of my wedding photos.
So I've heard some rules of schools of thought on this backup stuff. One, if it's not automated, it's not a backup.
Yeah, it's true.
Episode 30, our time machine wasn't working.
Yep.
The other, which goes in part number two, which is if your backups aren't being tested, it's not a backup.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You could have at least make sure that it's actually doing something.
Yeah.
You can't just set it and forget it and never check it again.
Set it and forget it. Yeah. I agree completely. It's really important. Honestly, I'm telling all of our listeners, if you have some sort of data that you think is really critical and important to you, to take care of it right now and put it somewhere where it can't die. Make sure you have it backed up somewhere because it'll happen.
Yep.
I use right now for documents and stuff, I'm using Dropbox, which is great.
Yeah, it is.
Because it used to be, you know, you'd put it on a flash drive and then copy it or email it so that you had it multiple places. But now any of my computers connected to Dropbox are essentially a backup of my work documents and my work projects.
Yeah, it makes it incredibly easy.
Yeah. So even if the Dropbox server died, you know, if the Dropbox service died, as long as my computers are on and talking to Dropbox until that point, I have a sync on, I have a copy on every one of my computers running Dropbox.
Yep. Well, that is the five things that can kill your site. Again, those are change. You know, want to be making drastic changes, unexpected load, the dig effects, slow death. You know, maybe restart your computer every once in a while, free up that memory, find out if there's any memory leaks. Maybe set an alert or something.
Yep.
The time-related issues, daylight savings times can cause all kinds of craziness. Remember the Zune bug? That was a time-related issue.
That was.
It killed all the Zunes for a day.
Yeah, every Zune device died for a day.
And number five, hardware failure.
So mad about that, for the record. For the record, I'm making my stance right now. I am a Zune lover.
I'm a lover of all Zunes.
I love the iPod Touch. I have an iPod Touch. Any other iPod, I hate. I'm not a fan of them.
I can't stand iTunes. That's my
problem. I hate iTunes. The Zune software is Windows only, which I hate, but I think it's a much better software than iTunes, personally. But yeah, Zune lover, and I had two in the house. Me and Amber have one.
Did you just get a new one?
Yeah, I just got another one.
So you got three in the house.
There's three in the house now. And I want to buy the Zune HD when it comes out. It's like an iPod Touch for Zunes.
That's cool.
Looks gorgeous.
Number five, the hardware failure. You know, if you're backing up, that's a good idea.
Yeah, and the guy in the article said that he really thinks that they are in order of importance, and he thinks that really you need to try and control change first. Really, before you go and just buy a bunch of hardware, try and you know, make sure that you're doing change right. Mm-hmm. You know, because that's it's the least expensive as far as money out of pocket. It's very expensive time and thinking wise, but yeah. But that's also, you know, if you're an entrepreneur or something like that, that's what you should enjoy doing. So, so do it.
All right.
So the next thing we want to talk about is the ultimate guide to web optimization. No, now you need to settle down, Mark.
I'm getting excited. I love all things optimization.
You do. Tweaking. You're really into that. And I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not. So I'm going to leave it up to you to convince me that these are important.
Okay. And I don't know why I'm like this, but I'm like, Python's slower than this, or, you know, assembly is the fastest. I should start learning that. It's like, it doesn't matter.
It can matter,
but, you know, I don't know. For some reason, I'm attracted to this optimization of all things.
Yeah, honestly, with what I'm any project that I'm working on right now in my state of my career, I don't have to worry about this in any way, shape, or form.
I was actually listening to the CS Berkeley computer science courses on, they have like a podcast on iTunes. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, you know, computers double every year. We know this, the Moore's Law. And it was interesting talk about, you know, you could wait a year and your programs would be twice as fast in some cases where it's linear.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's times to optimize and there's time not to. But I think web optimization is definitely something to look out for, because like we just talked about, the five things that kill your site is poor performance and load times. So
yeah, absolutely.
Talk about some of these.
All right. So first sort of chunk of optimization you could do is server-side optimization.
Yep, and the big one here is the web host. I mean, that controls so many factors, is your environment and where your host is, you know, located, and you know what kind of bandwidth they have, and is it, if you know, your servers are really slow, and
yeah.
So the quality of the host. A lot of times people just look, oh, I get this many megabytes and this much bandwidth. You got to really, I mean, there is quality in hosts. You pretty much get what you pay for, and when it comes to hosting.
Absolutely, and we just did, I think it was two or three episodes ago, we did a sort of web hosting guide.
Yeah, definitely check that out if you're interested in, if you're in the market for a host, definitely check out that episode.
And you've just recently actually switched to, not switched, you still have a virtual hosting solution with DreamHost, which we use as well.
Yep. Shared hosting.
But you also, shared hosting, but you also have a virtual private server now.
Yep.
As well, for some new stuff that you're doing. What do you think of that?
I know it's a little bit faster. It's a totally different beast. I mean, you essentially become a system admin at that point. Mm-hmm.
And that's what scares me about virtual private.
It can be scary.
I mean, to be honest with you, I consider myself a power user, and maybe I would say I'm a baby system administrator, but I still don't trust myself to have someone say, okay, this server is out on the internet, Jade, what do you think? And me to say, it's secure.
I'm not sure, but I think there are virtual private hosts that will give you like an image that's already set up for, you know, like here's an Ubuntu image that already has Apache and all this installed. Just use this folder.
Yeah.
So it's almost as easy as a shared host. But yeah, I noticed it's definitely a different quality of host where I was using the shared hosting.
It's episode 29, by the way, is where we talk about web hosting options.
Like a web host is critical.
Okay. I don't know. Web hosting is one of these weird things where I've had three or four of them, and I hope this doesn't happen with DreamHost, because I really like DreamHost. I'm really happy with DreamHost, and I hope some of my last hosts, though, they always start out really good, but as they get popular, it just, you know, starts getting worse and worse and worse and worse. I don't know. It's like
they've been around a long time.
Yeah, that's true. But it almost seems like, you know, the only hosting you can trust is you hosting.
Yeah.
Which I maybe means I need to bone up on my system administration and get a virtual private server. But
yeah. I've used anywhere from the 99 cents a month hosting to the $20 a month hosting.
Yeah.
And there's definitely a humongous difference between the two.
That's true. Absolutely. As far free as hosting is just, it's sketchy.
So, I mean, that is the number one thing. If you get a good host, you can easily double your load times and and things like that. So that's that would be step number one. Number two is host assets separately. This is more of, I don't know, if you have a large site, you might want to do this. This is kind of things like using Amazon S3 to host your images, but then your site content actually comes from your host. So you're offloading some of the bandwidth to like super high capacity servers and bandwidth pipes.
Well, and like hosting that stuff, let's say your average person using web hosting, the only sort of concern that they have performance-wise involving their host is performance of scripts being run. So let's say you could use like Nginx with Passenger on your virtual private server running the Rails, you know, the CPU intensive part, the scripts. But then if you have a DreamHost account, like you could host your CSS, your scripts, all that stuff that, you know, let's say that your only problem with DreamHost is that its CPU has kind of been sluggish. As far as just serving static stuff,
your bandwidth is okay.
Yeah, so I mean, if you have a DreamHost account, right, just shove it up on there.
Yeah. And sites like Twitter use this. They offload their images to Amazon S3.
Yep.
So, you know, this is a good, like, Slice Host, I think it's like 30 cents a gigabyte if you go over, where Amazon's like 10 cents or 12 cents or something like that. So it's a little bit cheaper. So you could, like, if you were if you had a Slice Host virtual private server and you were okay on your CPU usage, but your bandwidth is starting to creep higher, but you didn't necessarily need more memory, you could offload some of your images and get by bandwidth from Amazon instead.
Or if you're doing those. Well, I mean, a great example would be something like this podcast, right? WordPress is the only thing needing CPU, but our DreamHost account is, you know, if it gets to the point of getting too much bandwidth, because it's just serving files. Serving files requires bandwidth, not CPU. So, you know, if it gets too big, we might think about offloading just our dead file storage for our MP3 files to Amazon EC2.
Another thing you can do if
S3, simple storage solution.
Yep. Another thing you can do if you're having problems with your bandwidth, you know, if you're paying too much for bandwidth or whatever, is using Gzip. This will actually compress the pages a little bit and make at least the connection across the internet slower. Faster. It'll be a smaller size.
Yeah. So what happens when it does this? Does the browser uncompress it?
Yes. And Gzip
is... So it's unloading some of the file size, quote unquote.
Yep.
To the...
Over the internet. Okay. The slowest part, the slowest link. It's making that part smaller. Gzip is one of those compressions that is ridiculously fast. It's not the best compression, but it's the super fast. So like browsers can decompress it on the fly really fast. So you don't notice too much of a decompression.
Like slowdown. Okay.
But which makes it perfect candidate for what it's doing.
Yeah.
So to limit the load time across the internet, if you have a slow, I guess, connection between the server and your client, Gzip's great.
Cool.
Number four is minimize redirects. A lot of web browsers have it will only fetch 4 external links at a time. And so if you've got AdSense, maybe an Amazon ad and analytics and something else, you've already hit your 4 and it's going to have to load all those 4 before it starts loading other external things. Like maybe you've got CSS hosted over on Amazon S3. And so it's got to load all those and then it'll start loading the other one. It can cause slowdowns. So you want to, or did I say minimize redirects? I was thinking it was minimize external connections.
No, this is redirects.
Okay. Well, minimizing,
No, that's important.
You also want to minimize the external links.
Because
too.
Most, like you said, most browsers have a limit to 4. And sometimes just one of them will be dog slow. And sometimes analytics is really slow. Like I'll get angry at a website because I think it's slow, but I look down and it's actually trying to load the AdSense code and or the analytics code, and that's what's slowing it down.
Yeah, definitely put that at the bottom of the site.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
So back to redirects.
A lot of people use like meta redirects or JavaScript redirects, and these can be slow, usually because you have to load the whole page before, like especially with JavaScript, usually you load the whole page before it actually executes that command.
Yeah.
Because to do a redirect, you would usually say like body on load redirect, you know, blah.
A lot. Usually the best way is doing like Apache redirects.
Yep. 301 fastest. Or 302s, we found out. 302 is a temporary redirect. 301 is a permanent redirect.
So. Yep. Here's the one that I was talking about. Reduce DNS lookups.
There you go.
You don't. They're saying on the Yahoo Developer Network blog, it takes about 10 to 120 milliseconds for DNS to resolve an IP address. So if you've got a lot of different external assets, maybe you've got your images hosted on Amazon S3, you've got analytics and all these other places, it has to look up those DNS and resolve the IP address before it can even get them. And so you're losing some time
here. Or even if, let's say you do, you know, images.jaderobbins.com, css.jaderobbins.com. Yeah. I don't know why you do this, but like, you know, each one of those is a DNS lookup. You don't just look up everything for jaderobbins.com. Each time you go to a subdomain, you have to do a DNS lookup on those. So be careful.
So the first one on optimizing the assets is merge multiple JavaScripts into one file. You know, if you have multiple different JavaScript files, the browser has to load each one in separately, make a cache for each one. You know, it's a lot faster to load just one file, one larger file than as opposed to loading five smaller files.
Yeah. And you can do this on the fly, which I didn't know about using HDXs and PHP, which is cool because
it's less, I mean, it's not a hassle. It's just,
you and I talk about this a lot. Splitting up files is easier for programmers. It's easier for us to find stuff, but it's harder on the work on the end user sort of browser. Cool.
The next one is, and this one also can be a pain for programmers, but it's good to do for your end users, is compress JavaScript and CSS.
Absolutely.
What this means is, you know, JavaScript, when you write it, you, obviously as a programmer, you want to be able to read what you've wrote, written. So you've got, you know, you've got tabs and spaces and you've got a lot of white space, which are characters. That's actual that's data, being, you know, there. Minify will go in and remove all the white space, put everything on one line. It'll shorten things if it can. You know, it makes it very unreadable for a programmer, but it's way faster. Well, I wouldn't say way faster, but it is definitely a smaller file, which would lead to faster load times.
Yeah, these CSS and JavaScript are very are white space insensitive. They don't care what you do with white space. So it's nice for us as programmers because we can put in all this white space to make it easier for us to find stuff and organize the sort of process in our head, but they don't care. So you can use these minify things. I've been using Sass, which is a CSS markup language, and one of the default options in Sass is that when it converts it to CSS for you, it'll
minify it.
Yeah, minify it. So it's really cool.
With that, you have no reason not to minify it.
Exactly. And because I'm actually editing the code of the sort of pre-parsed JavaScript, and then I have to compile it and send it anyways.
Yeah, really, there's no nowadays. There's really no reason not to minify it, other than it's the hassle to doing it. But Sass takes a a lot of that hassle out. You know, a lot of people used to say, "Well, if I do that, then I can't view my own source through Firefox." But things with like Firebug and things,
it'll clean it up for you. It makes it readable anyways. Yeah, absolutely.
The next one is customize the header expiry caching. I've messed around with this, but I have to admit I don't know enough about it to recommend any specific like changes you should do right now.
It's just if you think things aren't going to change, set the cache to be longer. Yeah. Then it, you know, the cache doesn't expire and there's less requests.
Yeah.
Like if you know, I mean, if you just know that your image logo is not going to change, your logo, exactly. Your logo isn't going to change. You know, you change it once every 2 years.
Cache it. And the thing they get, like, let's say, sometimes they'll say cache it forever. And then what they'll do is they'll put a version number at the end, like V1, V2, V3. And if they want to change the logo but update everybody's stuff without having to keep this cache.
Exactly.
They can just change the name of the file. That's one way of doing it.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Number four, we kind of talked about this, was offload the assets. If you've got images, maybe put them on Flickr. There's a lot of free services for hosting images that you can link to and you can use kind of their bandwidth. JavaScript, you talked about this, the Google Ajax library, you can link to the JavaScript files. I always do that because chances are that some other site is also doing it and the user already has it cached, so they don't
like
have to
Google.
Download. Yeah, exactly.
If Google's doing it, you know, because everyone goes to Google anyways,
Web forms, Boofoo, we've talked about that in one of our episodes. RSS, Feedburner, definitely Feedburner is an awesome service. Why not have your feeds pull from there instead of your site? Which it pulls from your site.
Yeah, it has
anyways,
to pull from your site anyways. But the great part about it is it'll pull from your website once in a while, and everyone else, everyone else's random, you know, clients are pulling from them. But again, I actually wrote a little article, a little ditty about this on jrobbins.com. You also have to be careful when you offload stuff because you have to make sure you're offloading it to a reliable source. True. And you also have to know that you're accepting the risk that if these other sources get slow, it's going to slow you down.
True.
So you really need to think about it carefully. You know, if you upload to Flickr, that's great. Usually the Flickr is snappy and quick, but once in a while it'll bog down and it'll slow you down and it looks bad on you. It doesn't look bad for Flickr.
Yeah, chances are that Flickr is faster than your web host. But, like you said, sometimes, like Twitter has fail whales
exactly.
constantly.
Yeah. Yeah, even if sometimes you'll just see, even if they're just pulling the Twitter RSS feed, sometimes you'll see, it, you know, the load on someone's website is taking forever because it's just trying to get a hold of Twitter.
Yep. Another one, you know, if you have a survey or poll, there's SurveyMonkey and Poll Daddy, and I just saw another one. We were looking for web apps. There's a ton of those. So.
Yep.
The next one is handling web images. We talked about this, and we're going to actually do a segment a little bit on how to do this, is optimizing ping images. You know, a lot of people just go into the Photoshop and say save as for web or save for web as or whatever it's called, and they'll compress the image and they'll think, oh, this is good enough or this is the best it can get.
Yeah.
But actually, you can compress it further without losing any more quality with a lot of these cool services.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things it talks about too is don't scale your images. I wouldn't say a huge offender. I'm a minor offender of this because in WordPress, it actually does re-render smaller versions of the image for you. But sometimes I'll take those smaller versions and make them just a little bit smaller using the HTML width and height, which is bad.
Yeah.
At least it's not the full size image though.
Yeah, right. It does, what is it, thumbnail, medium size, and large size. So you'll pick, like, medium and then
just shrink it down, a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, the problem with scaling images with HTML, one, it can sometimes make the picture look bad.
Yeah, it does. Depends on the browser. You're depending upon the browser to re-render your image for you. And I know, like, for example, Internet Explorer made images look like crap.
Yeah. And the second one is your browser's still downloading the original source and then compressing it for you, so it's wasting.
It still has to download the entire image. So you've seen this on older or crappy websites where it's a little image that's 300 by 300, and it takes two minutes to load.
You're like, what is going on?
What the hell? So you right-click on it, and you hit View Image, it's and the thing monster. Is like a desktop wallpaper. It's like 2 megapixels, and you're like, what were they thinking?
That's dirty. That's about as dirty as it gets right there.
So dirty gurdy.
They're recommended a few apps here. We're not going to talk about them now because we're going to do a segment on all these.
Absolutely.
And show you how to use them.
Yeah, we're going to let Mark go crazy here in the future on a little segment about optimizing images. We're going to do some stuff with like the command line. He's going to tell you how to optimize using some the command line tools apps. Or online web apps using their APIs and whatnot. So it'll be coming down the pipe.
All right, number six, handling CSS. You know, use CSS sprites if you have like a navigation bar with multiple images that are, you know, like you've got a hover over link and then, you know, the regular image. You want to have the image in one GIF or ping or, you know, one image, but it's multiple little sections. And you can tell CSS to pull this section out of that image. So you only have one image call. The browser only has to download one image, and the CSS will cut that, kind of like slice it out and put it on there.
Okay, that's cool.
Amazon does this. Apple does. You know, there's tons of sites that do this, and it made load times faster.
Well, there's even like little tips, like maybe if you're gonna make a button with a hover, right? Make it so that the background color is what you have, and that the middle is transparent, and then do the hover in CSS. Just change the background color of the GIF, so where it's transparent on the image, it looks like the whole, you know, the color in the middle is changing colors, but it's actually HTML or CSS hovering, which is infinitely quicker.
Yeah, another example, like if you let's say you know Google does well. I'm trying to think of a website that does this. Amazon does it with their Amazon Prime and their homepage. But it's like you have a logo, but you have a little like a beta at the bottom. Like Gmail's got a little beta, and sometimes you display that and sometimes you don't. You can have one logo image that has all five logos or all six logos, and then you just pick that logo out with the CSS. The one that you're using on that particular.
Does that take longer to load? The initial load is longer, but
is
cached.
The image size is a little bit larger because it holds five images, but you're loading one image and then that's cached now.
Yeah.
And you're just using CSS to pick the one image out.
I see. Cool. Cool. I'm going to have to check that out. I've never done that before.
It's definitely useful for navigation and things like that where you need to load all the images anyways. Why not just put it all in one image load and then use CSS to point to it all? Mm-hmm.
So another thing they're talking about is sort of like reducing the amount of CSS files. Again, another advantage of something that compiles your CSS like SAS is that if you import SAS files in a SAS file, it literally imports and parses the other SAS. And it's not like you don't have a bunch of different CSS calls in your HTML. It combines them all into one big CSS file.
Yeah, as a programmer, it's nice to have main and body and footer, but for the end user in the browser, it's better to have one file you know, so use something like SAS or something that's going to compile it down for you.
All right, the next big chunk, which I am super pumped about, is optimization for WordPress. Okay. I love WordPress. It's yay. I've literally to the point of thinking of writing a couple
WordPress plugins.
No,
you love.
I'm
plugins.
Not that smart. I love plugins. I don't like writing them. I like using other people's business plan, like centered around WordPress. I love WordPress that much. I think it's really got a long legs. I think it's going to be around even longer. So, number one is cache a WordPress blog.
Yeah, I've seen statistics like and what people have said about this. You could have a WordPress that just, you know, doesn't have any caching, and it might be able to say, let's say it can serve 10,000 pages in an hour or 10 minutes or something. If you had super cache, you can almost do 10 times that.
Yeah, exactly.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So
there's plugins. WP Cache is the old one. WP Super Cache is the new one.
And it's super easy. You basically just turn it on, and it's on. Yeah. That's all there is to it.
And with the new version of WordPress installing plugins, you can do it all within WordPress. You don't have to go and download it and put it in your plugins folder or anything. It's super easy. There's no excuse to do this.
The one caution that I'll say about caches is make sure you turn it off if you're, you know, doing a quick change on the fly. You'll be like, what's going on?
It's not working. Well, but the super cache now is pretty smart about realizing if you change something, it refreshes the cache. So certain things like your CSS file and stuff or your template, you can't. But like if you change content within WordPress, the app itself is smart enough to know to refresh the cache for that particular page.
I know Rails, if it knows it's in the development section, it doesn't do any caching. But when you go switch over to the production, it knows that it's time to get serious.
It's time to buckle down.
So
the next one is deactivate and delete unused plugins. I agree completely. What I hate is that every WordPress upgrade comes with the Hello Dolly plugin because I delete it every time. It drives me nuts. But yeah, especially if you're not using a plugin, even if it's a widget that you're not using, deactivate it and get rid of it. You don't need it.
The next one is take a look, a little bit about look into your source code and see if there's any unnecessary tags you got hanging around.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just if there's if you can cut any more of these sort of WordPress hooks or WordPress function calls out, do it. It'll speed it up. And so I guess that's WordPress. It's a good way to speed up WordPress. It's just so popular. It's almost you have to touch on it anytime you talk about this stuff. But in general, so some really good just general resources for optimizing your website is Yahoo YSlow. You've talked about this a lot in the past. You really like it.
Yeah, YSlow is a cool Firefox extension that you can just download and install and go to your site, and it'll give you kind of a rating of A through A, B, kind of a school grade rating, A, B, C, D, E, F, or I guess there's no E. it will give you suggestions. It's saying, we noticed that you've got this thing not turned on. You don't have Gzip turned on. You should probably turn that on. Things like that. It's pretty cool. It's really easy to use.
You can also get a Firebug plugin called PageSpeed, which does also gives you like a performance summary very similar to YSlow. Like for example, here it's showing that someone is not using browser caching and they probably should be doing that to speed their stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a tool called Pingdom Tools.
Very similar.
Yeah, it looks as like all your calls and all your stuff and tells you how long each one of those individual things takes to load, and so you can find the bottleneck.
Yeah, look at how many external links that person has got.
Like, yeah, goodness.
20 of them.
Holy cow.
That'll slow you down.
So check it out. Look at your website. See what you can do to optimize them. I mean, it's hard when you're sort of like in the position that I am. I think, well, nothing of mine is ever going to explode that much, so I don't really need to think about it. But the truth is, with the way social news and social link sharing is today, you never know when you're going to blow up. Some random person could find your website and they could submit it to Dig, and you could be on the front page and your stuff could be down and no one can get to it and you've lost your opportunity.
Yeah. Before we close this one, I want to make sure that we talk about the Google Web Optimizer. They also have one that's really neat. It's more of a web app style, but you can do like A/B testing. You can do multivariate experiments on your webs loading and stuff. It's pretty cool.
So really comprehensive way to
definitely
hammer down how to optimize things.
Use YSlow and those other ones, but definitely check out Google Web Optimizer.
I see. Adding content that is not in good thinking, Mark. All right, well, that wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. I want to remind you guys that you can subscribe to the show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe if you're not. You can also leave feedback for the show going to by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Any of the ways that are listed on there, we're always checking, always looking, and always hoping to get some feedback from you guys. And give us a review on iTunes if you wouldn't mind. Like Mark and I, we just clearly stated this episode that we hate iTunes, but unfortunately, it's one of the best ways to sort of spread the word about your podcast. So if you can give us a review on there, even if it's a bad one, we'll take whatever we can get. We want to just know what people think of the show. Thanks, you guys, and we'll see you next week.